Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into Real College Podcast, and I'm your host for the week, Tosin. Politics have been on all of our minds over the past few weeks here at RCP. It's an election year, and as student journalists, we're making sure we stay up to date on what's going on. A few weeks ago, it was announced that Bernie Sanders would be holding a rally in Cedar Rapids ahead of the Iowa caucuses. After finding out Vampire Weekend would be performing, we decided to check out the event. Reporter Hannah Dove has more.
On February 1st, the Real College Podcast crew crammed into the K-Van and drove 4 hours to go to the Bernie Sanders political rally.
Cedar Rapids, thank you very much!
But, more importantly, the Real College Podcast crew crammed into the K-Van and drove 4 hours to see an entirely free Vampire Weekend concert. Indie or underground music and politics, especially liberal politics, have always gone hand in hand. Consider the MC5's decision to play a set before the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, or Radiohead's political trajectory in critiquing late-stage capitalism or neoliberalism since the 1980s. And indie pop icons Vampire Weekend are no different. Ever since Bernie Sanders' first go at the presidency in 2016, the band has consistently shown him support by playing at his rallies.
You know we gotta play one more for Bernie, right? We know he likes this one.
Vampire Weekend's frontman, Ezra Koenig, has said before in a Newsweek interview that he's kind of horrified by the cult of personality that tends to surround various political candidates, but also that he thinks that Bernie means what he says, and he's always said that his campaign is bigger than him. The night of the rally began with a performance by singer-songwriter Lissy Morris, mirroring Fleetwood Mac grooves and ending their set with an oddly patriotic cover of Paul Simon's America. However, seeing as Vampire Weekend sung a duet with Bernie of This Land Is Your Land during the last 2016 campaign race, the patriotism made a lot more sense in context. Though one of the political pundits quipped about how some of you may only be here for Vampire Weekend to much applause, it didn't feel as though Vampire Weekend was the main act. They were only an opener for Bernie. However, that feeling quickly faded as Vampire Weekend burst into an acoustic version of Harmony Hall and the crowd surged forward in a frenzy as hot and bothered as one could get in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Vampire Weekend's lyrics have always been politically charged, with their latest album, Father of the Bride, dealing with such topics as environmentalism, political fatigue, and the intersection of Jewishness and whiteness in particular, a theme of exploration and morality that harkens back to their 2013 song, Finger Back, and makes its way into Harmony Hall as well as thematically in Jerusalem, New York, Berlin. Koenig noted in a 2014 interview that he considers himself politically engaged and that he's constantly trying to understand the way the world works, see behind the headlines, read deeply, and meet people. He has yet to find a balance of political beliefs in a music career, but sees Vampire Weekend's work as having a political dimension. However, there is a vast shift in tone in Vampire Weekend's support of Bernie from 2016 onwards to 2020, a type of critical introspection taking place, less chill, as Koenig noted, in 2016, and more fervent in its polarizing nature, which the band is attempting to distance itself from by making their lyrics, however political, still somewhat ambiguous in nature, along with a refusal to fully explain some of the lyricism in interviews. At the end of the rally, Vampire Weekend managed to fit a snapshot of each of their albums into an hour, mixing together old hits such as Walcott, along with new bops, Gold Rush and This Life, off of their latest album, Father of the Bride, along with a lightning round including Deep Cuts, California English Part 2, a song from the Peter Rabbit movie, and a cover of The Boys Are Back in Town. Though the band may still be figuring out their political boundaries both publicly and personally, their choice to play at Bernie Sanders' political rallies speaks louder than the ambiguities that they place into their lyrics and their interviews, and speak to a trend of indie rock speaking to politics and sometimes politics speaking back to indie music across the veil. With RCP, this is Hannah, signing off.
While Hannah explored the musical side of the event, I wondered what drew event attendees to the rally. While a free Vampire Weekend concert is a pretty compelling reason for hundreds of people to fill an event center, I figured there had to be a little more to the story.
After doing a little bit of homework, I felt the best thing I could do is volunteer my time.
I wanted to know why people took time out of their schedules to attend a political rally in Iowa, so I asked around.
My name's Amara Spencer.
How long have you been volunteering for Bernie?
For about 2 months now.
What drew you to his campaign?
Well, I actually caucused for him in 2016. It was my first Iowa caucus after I moved here. And then I had kind of jumped the ship for Elizabeth Warren because I was concerned about electability. But then I went back after I went to the rally in Iowa City with AOC and Bernie.
Statements like these weren't uncommon with people I talked to. Even though they were now willing to go as far as traveling out of state to canvass for Bernie, many had initially been wary about him, his policies, and, for one woman, his party affiliation.
I used to be a Republican, but I didn't really know much. My family were Republicans, my husband's family were Republicans, I grew up in Indiana. I'm like, okay, that's what I do.
Amy later moved to New York, where her friend Delia encouraged her to move past her cynicism and become more politically engaged.
I'd kind of given up a little bit. I'm just like, oh my God, everyone's awful. Everyone's dishonest. Everyone has their own agenda. Corporations buy our politics. Why vote?
So then I told her, you need to vote. Those are all the reasons why you have to get out and vote and register.
So then someone I respected a lot posted something about Bernie after he said he was going to run. And she was so excited. I'm like, who is this Bernie? Anyway, the rest is history.
Frank Burns, another volunteer I spoke to, also experienced differing levels of political engagement over time.
I think I'd been relatively politically involved when I was younger. Then I went through a phase sort of where I stopped being as involved. And then actually I started getting more involved when Barack Obama ran. And since then I've been getting, you know, more and more involved politically.
How long have you been volunteering with Bernie?
I did volunteer work for him in 2016 and since April of 2019.
Through my brief conversations at the rally, I became increasingly impressed with people's dedication to being involved in the political process. It was really inspiring to see so many people choose to abandon apathy and instead choose action. Regardless of party affiliations or candidate endorsements, it's often refreshing to be around people who are vocal and unashamed about how much they care about things. After the rally, we headed home. I later found out that a friend of mine had also been in Iowa that weekend. While we had gone to cover the rally and concert, she had been on a bus of volunteers on their way to knock on doors and convince voters to caucus for Bernie. She mentioned that one of the volunteers on her bus was an artist who had created a Bernie zine. Driven by a strong love for zines, as well as a journalistic curiosity about the artist, I scheduled an interview within a few days.
Where do you publish these anywhere?
I put them online, on Twitter and Instagram and on my website. I think I also post them to Reddit usually, just kind of trying to like...
That's Harry Gao, an artist and grad student at the Minneapolis College of Art and Design. After I got back from Cedar Rapids, we sat down to talk about art and politics and how they can often go hand in hand.
For publishing, I don't actually have like a publisher or a platform or anything really, so I'm just trying to like get it out there however I can.
Yeah. What has the response been?
It's been pretty positive, I'd say. The thing about art is, like, it's only doing any good if it's in front of people, right? Like, if people aren't looking at your art, no matter how good it is, then it's not doing anything out in the world. So the fact that so many people have kind of latched onto this is really exciting. a lot of people are, they're finding some strength in it, you know, something that feels really great, right? Because I make this work in part to put it out there so people can see, but in part to help me process things as we go through this cycle. And the fact that it can help other people do that is really powerful.
Was that your intention, to help other people process, or did you have a different goal in mind?
I'd say that, yeah, that was my intent. I mean, I sort of start from what I think helps me, right? You know, I start from what do I find appealing about the Bernie campaign, and also what do I need help with? And when I think about what I need, usually I think that, you know, I'm not that special, right? People are very similar to each other all the time. And if I'm having difficulty with something, then I imagine somebody out there is also having difficulty, right? So when I think about it in that way, then it kind of helps focus, because then I can be like, okay, I'll make something for what I'm feeling right now. But I hope that I can get it out there in front of somebody else who's feeling that same way.
Later in our conversation, Harry expanded on this idea of emotions and connecting with people in a way that goes beyond politics.
A lot of people think there's a big distinction between politics and, you know, like personal stuff and emotional stuff and social stuff and whatnot. And I just don't think that's the case, right? It's about empowering people and making sure that we are connecting with each other, right? If you want to go out and volunteer, like, there's an entire organization that is trying to find ways to plug you in and let you do something and be part of something, right? Instead of feeling like you're alone out here. I don't like to think of politics and the rest of life as being separate things. Politics is life, and life is politics. And sometimes that's a sad thing, but sometimes that's a really empowering way of looking at it as well.
As Harry and I spoke, I flipped through a copy of one of their zines.
I noticed here with these zines, they don't have your name on them. Was that, like, intentional?
It was. You know, I'm making this work for the sake of the campaign. I'm not really in it to self-advertise, right? If I can not have my name on this, it helps that in some ways, right? Because this isn't about me just trying to make sure, like, people are looking at my stuff. This isn't about me benefiting from this. This is about what I can do for others through this work.
While this episode has been largely focused on national politics, it's important to note things that are happening on a local level as well. Producer Ben Hallam spoke to a University of Minnesota student who's attempting to make his way into local politics.
Well, my name's Austin Berger. I am 21 years old. I was 20 when I launched this campaign. And I'm running for the Minnesota House of Representatives. That's the state house in District 45A. That includes 4 precincts in the city of Crystal, 3 precincts in the city of Plymouth, and 7 precincts in the town I've been a lifelong resident of, New Hope.
This past December, I read a story in the Minnesota Daily about a University of Minnesota student and former member of student government, Austin Berger, who had announced a campaign for the Minnesota House seat 45A to replace Lyndon Carlson, a longtime DFL incumbent who recently announced his retirement. I was immediately interested, and I thought it would be a great story. I wanted to find out how a career in student government prepares you to become a politician, and whether someone my own age could really be prepared to take on the role of a legislator. Austin certainly made a convincing argument, drawing on his experience interning with Minnesota state senators and working on legislative teams in the Capitol.
I think when we talk about experience in young people, we like to point out that young people don't have, say, a 20-year CV under their belt or any other manner of qualification that tends to be more typical or par for the course for today's politics. And that's the thing. We do have experience as young folks running for office. It's just not the kind of experience that has been conventional. I don't need a law degree to tell you how a bill is crafted and how to build consensus on it, because I went there on the front lines in the Capitol to learn how to do that. I think I'm qualified to be a Minnesota House representative because I've seen the work they do. I have an intimate appreciation for the nuances of policymaking at the Capitol in St. Paul. And I know I can do the job and that I can do it right.
Austin also went past his resume at the Minnesota State Legislature, arguing that his experience in youth activism was another qualification for office that many older candidates wouldn't have.
Back in March 2018, I helped organize the March for Our Lives at the Minnesota State Capitol.
And that was the first time I ever gave a speech in public, was in front of 20,000 people on the steps of the Capitol. I had never felt more comfortable behind that podium than I had anywhere in my life. And it's because I realized that the words I was speaking into that microphone, they were giving people hope. And ever since then, I've just always been trying to fight for that which inspires hope among people. Things like shutting down
downtown Minneapolis. But one key part of Austin's resume, and part of what intrigued me about his candidacy, was his experience in student government. I wondered, how did Austin's experience in student government prepare him for state government? And how might his record in student government reflect on his qualifications for office? I was especially interested to find out more about his resignation from his position as MSA representative to the Student Senate Consultative Committee in mid-October of last year. What I found out was, to put it simply, complicated. Austin's former colleagues had a decidedly mixed view of his time in office, one that reflected an admiration of his political acumen, combined with a sense of concern about how far he might go. Take Cassidy Drummond, who worked under Austin in the Student Senate.
I do think he, I've always felt conflicted because it's like he does problematic things, but I do think he has good intentions when he does them. But then also I think some of the motivation behind it is like, I mean, I always think it is kind of somewhat in for political gain, but I do think he has good intentions when he did the things that he did. I do think he would be a great politician because I think in politics, like it is about people pleasing. It is about making people feel heard. And I don't think like a lot of politicians are necessarily genuine most of the time. I've always seen him in this position as a politician. And as far as like getting things done in student government, like he was always like anything he was passionate about, like he was going to get done and like he was going to do the research and reach out to the people he needed. And I do think he was like a great senator. Again, it's like not
those
one to really have
things that he did
kind of
that
like,
Cassidy
oh,
mentioned
right.
were one of the hardest parts of this story to pin down. I asked Austin about the events surrounding his resignation from the Minnesota Student Association in October of last year, but he cited the toxic culture in MSA and claimed that he simply wanted to use his time more usefully and could not do so in the organization. However, several former MSA members who I spoke to on background, but who wished to remain anonymous, characterized Austin as a part of this toxic culture. I spoke with one member of MSA, Jude Goossens, the current head of legislative and government affairs for the Minnesota Student Association, about his experience with
Austin. Being very explicit, I'm not commenting on his campaign. In my experience, objectively, he was the source of targeted attacks, spreading misinformation, and abusing his position of power in an extremely inappropriate way. So it was, early September. Pending my confirmation in forum, Austin sent out an email to all of the senators that were in forum. And in that email, he claimed that I was going to be giving a voice of approval to one of our city councilors about that project, the Dinkytown development, the one that was going to take up the McDonald's, like that half block with McDonald's and Dinkytown One and Spirits, and that whole area. And kind of painting that in a very negative sense. And the way that he framed it was basically, there's going to be a vote happening. I hope that you all take this information and act on that. Again, wanting to note explicitly that information that he gave to all of them was false. So we weren't for or against the property anyway, because it's more complicated than that, to be frank. Like, I'm not saying this as like in the sense that woe is me. Just wanted to be very objective about the facts of, my experience with him was not positive. There was dishonesty. There was, personal vendetta. There was trying to use his power to influence people against me based on misinformation that he was telling them, and I just find that to be highly inappropriate. He did inevitably resign.
But despite some concerns that remained, Austin Berger's campaign seemed to have left these MSA squabbles behind when I attended a campaign fundraiser at Mancini's. There, the focus was on youth and on the future. Joe Selton, a longtime member of the 45th House District and retirement coordinator for the Machinist Union, expressed the sentiment many people at the fundraiser felt toward Berger's campaign and their optimism for his future.
I'm glad to see some younger people stepping up to take on some of the reins that we need to have taken on. They come with a better perspective of what's going on. Austin seems to be a guy that will fill the bill for us. He's got fire in his belly. I think he'll do a good job for us. So that's why I came down here to donate some time and some money.
I think that if reporting on Austin Berger's campaign taught me one thing about what it means to run for office as a college student, it's this. For a young candidate with such a short record, what's most important are the things they did most recently. For candidates like Austin Berger, that includes both youthful political fire and passion. But it also includes the petty conflict that characterizes so much of life in college and earlier. For Real College Podcast,
I'm Ben Hallam.
That's all for this special episode of Real College Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Thanks to Hannah Dove for looking into the connection between music and political activism, and thank you to producer Ben Hallam for his story. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It's produced by me, Tosin Fasimo, Ben Hallam, and Casey McCabe. Nathan Fervoy is the host and managing editor. All episodes of the podcast can be found online at radiok.org or on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.